Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future.
The people's flag is deepest red, it shrouded off the mass of day. And ere the limbs grew stiff and cold, their heart's blood died in every fold. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying near.
I'm speaking today with David Glenn. David Glenn is a staff reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education and an old personal friend. And David's just written an article called Lending a Lasting Hand in the Chronicle. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
And the Lending a Lasting Hand article goes through some of the folks who have been addressing a topic that is near and dear to my heart. And I've actually had Carl Witterquist on this program just a couple months ago talking about basic income. But let's talk about some of the things that you learned in this article. First, this seems to me now a much more pertinence to public policy, although very few people are talking about the idea of basic income because of the job loss economy. Is that one of the reasons why you decided to address the article now?
Well, that is one of the concerns that some of these folks have. The article looks at three different proposals for radically reducing poverty or unemployment or both, depending on the proposal. One is the universal basic income grant, which you discussed with Carl Witterquist recently. Another is a proposal to sort of revive the New Deal model in which the federal government guarantees jobs to anyone who wants one. And the third is a proposal for the federal government to give subsidies to private employers who hire people with relatively low skills.
Now, the third proposal, the subsidies to people with low skills, that's something that a lot of states and federal government have experimented with in the past, haven't they?
That's right, although not on the scale that this particular proposal imagines. This is an idea that's mostly associated with a guy named Edmund Phelps, who's a professor emeritus of economics at Columbia. He's been promoting this idea for 30 years or more, most extensively in a book from a few years ago called Rewarding Work. And it's also recently been publicized and endorsed in a book by the political columnist Matthew Miller called The 2% Solution, which is essentially a set of policy proposals that he hopes that the Democrats will take on this year. Most of the state experiments with subsidies to private employers have been time-based. You know, for example, purely hypothetical, but the state of South Dakota might give a subsidy to an employer like Marriott Hotel to hire a former welfare recipient for a six-month period. And then what has often happened in such cases is that at the end of the six-month period, the employer finds an excuse to fire the person and take on a new person fresh from welfare and get a new set of subsidies. Phelps claims that his proposal would not involve that kind of problem because these would be, in a sense, permanent and universal subsidies. It would, in a sense, take the form of a universal boost to the minimum wage, although most of the money would actually be coming out of the government's pocket and not out of the private employers.
Now, as you say in the article, that one of the objections to this is that employers would use the wages to replace the wages that they would otherwise be paying their employees and then pocket the difference.
That's right, and that's something that very many people are concerned about with this proposal, that employers would find a way to game the system, that they would find ways to reclassify employees, that that they would fraudulently report that some employees were full-time when they were not. For somewhat technical reasons, Phelps claims that all of this is essentially impossible, that as long as you have a free economy in which workers can move from one firm to another, that they'll always be able to get the private wage that their productivity warrants, according to his model. And that would work in part, he says, because his subsidy would be sort of a sliding scale. So you'd get a very large subsidy if your standard private wage was $6 an hour, and a very small subsidy if your standard private wage that you could command on the market was around $11 or $11.50. And the subsidies would phase out entirely around $12 an hour.
It seems like this might have cross-partisan appeal, this kind of a proposal, because the alternative for folks who are unemployed is either to have the government pay them to not work or have the government pay them to work. And in general, people in the right wing of the spectrum would prefer that the private sector be involved in the loop someplace.
That's right, and Phelps himself imagines that his proposal would entirely replace most of the means-tested programs that we now know. There would be no more welfare, no more food stamps. I'm not sure what he says about Medicaid. And for that reason, his proposal is at least superficially attractive to some conservatives.
Now, the universal WPA kind of employment opportunities, who are the folks that are backing that in the current environment?
That's mostly associated with a group of economists at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, who also run a think tank called the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. This is a school of economists known as neo-Keynesians, and they make a number of sort of esoteric arguments about money supply. But the gist of their policy proposal is that the federal government would guarantee jobs to anyone who's willing and able to take them. These jobs would all pay the same wage. So if you were previously earning a fairly high salary at a high tech firm and you were laid off, you would be offered a low wage job by one of these federal programs. And their idea is that these government guaranteed jobs would be no more attractive than the least attractive job in the private sector. And I should hasten to add there that they also imagine, as part of this package, that they would make private sector jobs generally more attractive than they are today, in part by raising the minimum wage and permanently indexing it to inflation.
I'm speaking with David Glenn. He's an author of the article Lending a Lasting Hand in the Chronicle of Higher Education this last week. Now, I've always been puzzled by one of these conundrums in public policy, the difference between workfare as a kind of general direction that we could go and the idea that everyone should have a job instead of welfare. I mean, it seems like one of the principal left-wing complaints or liberal complaints about workfare has been that we would coerce people into jobs that don't pay well enough and don't have benefits and don't have childcare associated with them and don't do as much for you as having welfare. How would these universal employment strategies differ from just workfare?
The Kansas City employment of last resort model would not necessarily be very different from workfare. I mean, I just mentioned that they would want to, in addition to their government-created jobs, also improve the quality of existing private sector jobs. But to the extent that they did not do that, then most of the concerns that liberals have with workfare might also apply to their scheme.
So the basic income would be the answer to all those things.
Well, that's what basic income proponents claim, yes. Yeah. I should also mention that there's another liberal critique of all three of these proposals that I heard in the course of researching this article. I spoke with folks at the left-wing think tank, the Economic Policy Institute, who were concerned that all three of these proposals, in effect, concede too much to market mechanisms. They say that it's more important and more feasible for the state to subsidize or directly provide basic goods like housing, education, and health care, whereas all three of the proposals that I've written about are really, in the end, about getting cash into the hands of poor people. This week in The Onion, there was a parody in which the U.S. government decided to distribute its $87 billion aid package to Iraq by giving each Iraqi citizen a grant of $3,544.
Which would be an enormous amount in Iraq.
Right. One of the jokes of the Onion parody is the idea that if you give cash to each person, then there's no money left for doing things like writing a constitution or building schools. And in an environment or in a policy environment like this, you wouldn't necessarily wind up providing those public goods at all.
Right.
And so the Onion, in a weird way, sort of harmonized with the critique that I heard from liberals at the Economic Policy Institute.
Okay, but before we go that direction, tell us about what Von Parrish and these other, and Carl Wittequist. Just remind the listeners who didn't hear my interview with Carl Wittequist, what's the basic income proposal all about?
Well, that's an idea that would have the government give a fixed amount to every citizen every month, and it would be purely universal. You would get the universal basic income regardless of your general wealth or income, so Donald Trump would receive it as well as a poor person here in Washington. It would be regardless of your family composition, so there would be no incentives one way or the other for you to get married or to have children, and you'd get it regardless of whether you were working. That's an idea that has been floated as early as the mid-19th century by folks like Charles Fourier and John Stuart Mill. There was a revival of interest in models like that in the early 1970s by economists like Milton Friedman. But this political philosopher, Philippe von Parage, is the best-known current proponent.
Now, you mentioned the various countries' political viability of this idea. From your review, does it seem like it's really gaining momentum outside of the United States, places like Europe and Australia?
But there is reason to believe that in Europe, at least, that there's some movement in this direction. Most Western European countries have some kind of guaranteed minimum income for people who do not work. And many of those same countries also have something like the U.S. Earned income tax credit for people who do work. And so Van Parage suggested to me that it's only a matter of time before those two programs are combined. And then what you would have, in a sense, would be something like his universal basic income guarantee. There has also been momentum for a basic income in countries like Brazil and South Africa. Next month in February, here in Washington, there will be a meeting of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network, and one of the major speakers there will be a Brazilian senator, Eduardo Suplicy, who has been one of the major champions of the Brazilian plan, which was just signed into law by the Brazilian legislature in November. It's going to begin at a very small scale there.
I was supposed to this week be going to Nigeria to address a conference about robotics in Nigeria, and it turns out that I'm not going. But one of the things that I had been thinking about saying to the Nigerians was that a lot of the policy questions that will the first world, the developed world, will have to face will immediately impact through trade and globalization on the developing world. And it has a ramification for this debate because you mentioned that South Africa has been thinking about this basic income proposal as well as Brazil, which seems mind-boggling given that they have these huge development problems, and you would think that any disincentive for people to, you know, leave their farms or whatever and get industrial work and become part of the pay economy, the wage slavery economy, would be terrible for their economies, and that the only folks who should be considering this kind of a proposal are the folks with structural developed world affluence and structural unemployment in the developed world. But how could it possibly work that South Africans could give people basic income and give people disincentives for working?
Well, that's an interesting question. One response to that objection has been for some of these proposals in places like Brazil and South Africa to be contingent on other kinds of human capital formation, to use the jargon, that families are eligible for certain kinds of income grants if and only if they consistently send their kids to school. So the notion is that you, even if you're providing new disincentives for work, that you are at least building the skills of the next generation.
That makes sense. And what do you think about that proposal? I know that you're neutral here, but which of these three do you think has any legs? I mean, I don't hear any of this kind of debate happening in the current policy and climate.
Yes, I mean, it's in some ways sort of astonishing that none of the Democratic presidential candidates have even raised this set of issues very loudly. If they were to raise these issues, they would likely raise much more moderate policy proposals, something like an expansion of the earned income tax credit. But in general, these, you know, themes of poverty and unemployment have been almost unheard, except, I suppose, from the Kucinich and Sharpton campaigns.
Well, and it's especially astonishing to me, given that the economic news is so mixed. I mean, it really points, we did, in fact, develop a new economy in the 1990s, but it wasn't at all the kind of stock market goes to 30,000 and everybody has affluence economy. It's the economy of general structural unemployment after 30 or 40 years, if things go the way that they're going now.
Many people in the U.S. who have been concerned with this notion of structural unemployment and automation, the notion of an end of jobs, have endorsed the notion of a basic income guarantee. Stanley Aronowitz, a professor in New York City, who's a proponent of the end of jobs hypothesis, will be speaking at the basic income conference here in Washington in February.
So will I.
But it's interesting to note that Philippe von Parage himself is actually agnostic on that question. He does not necessarily believe that there is a structural decline in full-time work. He believes that having a basic income guarantee would allow a greater number of citizens to finesse these issues, perhaps by taking part-time jobs that would not otherwise be attractive to them without the basic income, And he also argues that it would make the labor market generally much more flexible, because if you had this basic subsistence income guaranteed, that you could more comfortably take time off from work to learn new skills.
Well, actually, Andre Gortz wrote about this in Farewell to the Working Class. He argued that it would be that capitalism had this dynamic of getting rid of labor through automation and de-skilling, but that it wouldn't necessarily occur because capitalism also had the capacity to force us to want more and more things that we could only achieve by working in more and more irrelevant kinds of work, which I think is an interesting argument if you look around at the economy with this kind of critical eye about which kinds of jobs do we really need. It could be that a basic income would keep us from having to sell ourselves in order to buy more Nintendo, and we'd be able to make some kind of other choices with our lives.
Yes, that's an explicit theme of the basic income proposal, and it's also implicit in an interesting way in the Kansas City guaranteed job proposal. The Kansas City scholars imagine that these government-guaranteed jobs would actually mostly be provided by local nonprofits. I won't get into the technical details of how they imagine this would happen, but essentially there would be federal government grants for each region.
Excellent. Well, I want to recommend to people that they, if those of you at least who have access to the Chronicle online, and if you're in and around a university, of course, you can find it in any library. The Chronicle of Higher Education has the most recent article by David Glenn, Lending a Lasting Hand. Thanks so much for joining us today, David.
Thanks very much.
This is from the piece, Lending a Lasting Hand, by David Glenn, that we were just discussing in the Chronicle of Higher Education this last week, January 16th, 2004. An ideologically diverse group of scholars is putting forward sweeping proposals that they say would transform the low-wage labor market for the benefit of poor people and society at large. One plan would guarantee all citizens a small basic income. Another would revive the New Deal model of a government-created job for anyone who wants one. Still another would provide huge public subsidies to private employers in order to raise the wages of low-skilled workers. The proponents of these schemes, as you can readily imagine, do not always agree with one another, but their proposals have a few common denominators. The plans are all designed as universal benefits and are intended to avoid the perverse incentives against work and against marriage that have afflicted the U.S. welfare system. In all the proposals, yes, even the guaranteed job scheme, are touted by their designers as minimizing government bureaucracy and micromanagement of the economy. These plans are thoroughly post-socialist, these scholars say. We can provide much more to people at the bottom of the ladder and still allow the free market to do its thing. The most controversial of the plans is the universal basic income, whose best-known contemporary proponent is Philip von Perisch, a professor of economic and moral philosophy at the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium. In his 1995 book, Real Freedom for All, What, If Anything, Can Justify Capitalism, von Perisch argues that the liberal value of freedom presumes that humans have an array of realistic choices, and having such choices, he says, depends in turn on having at least a certain level of resources. Therefore, society should guarantee everyone a basic income, which would be financed through progressive taxation. The basic income, von Perisch says, should be as large as the economy can efficiently sustain. The most common objection to von Perisch's model is that it would represent an unfair transfer of resources from people who do productive work to people who choose not to. Scholars like to refer to this as the Malibu surfer problem. Von Perisch argues that the liberal principle of neutrality among conceptions of the good life, as articulated by such philosophers as Ronald Dworkin and the late John Rawls, demands that the state not favor the industrious, that is, the crazy, as von Perisch facetiously calls them, over the lazy. Von Perisch also makes a more subtle point. He says that the universal basic income might actually draw certain unemployed people into the labor market. Quote, part of what motivated this plan, he says, was an awareness that the existing benefit schemes tend to create dependency traps, unquote. In means-tested benefit programs like the U.S. welfare system, you can often immediately lose all your benefits if you take a job. But, quote, if you have this floor of income that you're entitled to no matter what, he says, that's a way of getting out of that trap, unquote. The same insight lay behind the conservative economist Milton Friedman's early 1970s proposal for a negative income tax, which would be structurally similar to von Paresha's universal basic income. Would von Paresha's proposal wreck the economy by shrinking the pool of workers willing to work for low pay? I don't think the decrease in labor supply would be as severe as some commentators believe, says Michael A. Lewis, an assistant professor of social welfare at SUNY Stony Brook and a proponent of the basic income. Employers would tend to increase the wages they offer, and that would draw people back in. Von Paresha does not believe that low-wage jobs would disappear, but he believes that a certain kind of low-wage work would vanish. Jobs with low immediate productivity, but that offer serious training or opportunities for advancement through social networks would be able to find people to fill them, he says. On the other hand, if you have really lousy jobs that don't offer any training, that are done under bosses that treat workers badly, these sorts of dead-end jobs would be more difficult to fill than ever. Mr. von Paresha would not mourn the loss of such jobs. Just as there is nothing particularly good about slavery, he said, there is nothing particularly good about a system in which lousy jobs can be easily filled, he says. The basic income idea also has generated active political movements in two unlikely countries, Brazil and South Africa. In December, the Brazilian Congress approved a bill that will create a basic income beginning in 2005, though the plan will initially focus on Brazil's poor citizens. Meanwhile, in South Africa, there is a growing popular movement for a universal basic income. That's an excerpt from David Glenn's piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education, dated January 16, 2004, Lending a Lasting Hand. Here's a bit of a recent post that I had on the cyborgdemocracy.net blog that we maintain, Cyborg Democracy. I'm a big supporter of the space program, and my initial reaction to Bush's initiative to put a settlement on the moon and Mars is enthusiasm. But there are many important questions here. First, are the legitimate political concerns about what kind of priorities the Bush administration has in proposing a hugely expensive program while they're pushing the U.S. into massive debt with military expansion and tax cuts for the rich? Those fiscal and priority concerns drive the results of recent polls, which find a majority of Americans opposing the Bush space program. Young people, whites, Republicans, and men are the most supportive, but even majorities of those groups opposed the program when the multi-billion-dollar price tag was mentioned. But probably the most important fan is Bush's big corporate allies in the aerospace industries, according to one recent article that said, U.S. aerospace groups were drooling over President George Bush's program to resume manned flights to the moon and build a base there as a stepping stone for manned missions to Mars and beyond. Quote, as a company, we are very excited about the announcement, Boeing Space Division spokesman Ed Meamy said of Bush's speech. Quote, obviously, we are very excited to hear the White House issuing this policy, which is likely to strengthen the space market, said Kimberly Campbell, marketing director of SpaceHab, which furnishes resupply modules for the orbiting ISS, the International Space Station. Quote, this is good news for the entire industry, said Evan McCollum, communications director for Lockheed Martin Space Systems. No doubt all of these organizations heavily support the Republican Party and President George Bush. There are also some serious ecological questions being raised about the potential use of nuclear-fueled rockets in the plan, especially the trip to Mars. Physicist, left-winger, and transhumanist-inclined futurist Michio Kaku, for instance, weighs in on behalf of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space's campaign against nuclear-powered flights. And at a recent article, with press release from them says, according to Dr. Kaku, perhaps one of the greatest risks facing this ambitious program is the use of dangerous, unproven technologies which could backfire, eroding public confidence in the space program. One such dangerous technology is the nuclear rocket, which is now seriously being reconsidered after being rightly rejected for over several decades. The nuclear rocket booster has gone through many stages of development in the past, and all of them have been canceled with good cause. The Nukes in Space movement, or should I say the front organization for whatever corporate interests would likely benefit from this technology, begs to differ. If we do develop a safe, clean, effective propulsion method, then it's a whole new ball game. Asteroid mining might, for instance, also be in the offing. Another reason to have suspicions about this that is raised by the campaign against nuclear weapons in space is that it continues a pattern of the United States abrogating or ignoring or not signing on to UN treaties on the moon and space, treaties which forbid national or private property claims in the solar system. So if the U.S. tries to establish colonies on the moon and Mars, it would likely lead to international conflict over who exactly owns the parcels of property that the U.S. would then colonize. Also, there is a clear strategic military mission here to counter Chinese plans to colonize the moon and the Mars, which they have also announced. The Air Force Space Command strategic plan, which has been online for years, is very explicit about the U.S.'s mission in space and says, effective use of space-based resources provides a continual and global presence over key areas of the world. Military forces have always viewed the high ground position as one of dominance. With rare exception, whoever owned the high ground owned the fight. Space is the ultimate high ground of U.S. military operations. Today, control of this high ground means superiority and significant force enhancement. Tomorrow, ownership may mean instant engagement anywhere in the world. Simon Smith, the editor of Better Humans magazine, weighs in this week with an anti-manned space pro-robots editorial. He argues that the spin-off benefits of the investment are too indirect compared to the enormous benefits to be gained from investing in anti-aging and intelligence enhancement research. Quote, advocates of manned space exploration fail to point out just how much we'd need to alter the human body to make it suitable for exploring the cosmos. Surviving the long-term exposure to space radiation alone would probably necessitate biological changes that would most efficiently be addressed through genetic engineering. Sending humans without modifications on space missions would be completely impractical if genetic interventions existed. As an extreme and possibly unfeasible example, genetically engineered astronauts to photosynthesize would reduce the need for them to store large amounts of food. Robots won't be the solution forever either. Eventually, manned space exploration will make sense, but for now, we should let the robots explore outer space while we explore inner space and directly advance humanity. Instead of engineering for manned space stations, let's work on engineering humans. Then, when we're smarter, stronger, and longer lived, and mature enough to handle the challenges and responsibilities of traveling the universe, we can boldly go. At any rate, Bush's proposal is only modestly funded so far and phased in over decades, so he really isn't proposing anything but ideas. I like the ideas, but when we do expropriate back the stolen billions from the corporate robber barons, I suggest we invest them in the human beings first and wait for advances in propulsion, nanotech, genetic engineering, and so forth that would make colonizing the moon and Mars practical. We may not have to wait long. Simon is, in fact, plugged into the mood of the people, since surveys this week also found that not only did majorities want to prioritize human needs over space right now, but majorities thought we should send cheaper robots to do our space exploration until we have served human needs on Earth a little better. That's from Cyborg Democracy blog at cyborgdemocracy.net. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. You can also check out past and future shows, archived in streaming MP3, and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.